It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and here is what the week's top stories sounded like.
We all make this campaign what it is. We make this campaign different.
We just have produced zero when it comes to any meaningful carbon reduction plans.
Crews are prepping the town for the Wolverine fire by cutting fire lines and trimming back branches.
Everywhere you see dirt in the field, I was digging, trying to stop the fire coming this way.
I've heard consistent concerns expressed about the hookah lounges and the crime and disorder.
Today was a good day for us. First day to get shoulder pads on and get to banging a little bit. A really important start for the young guys to start to show us who they are and what they're all about.
Well, it's election season, of course, in Washington. We saw the first rumbling of a shakeup on the Seattle City Council, and maybe in Snohomish County, too. Wildfires are still scorching the state, and the Seahawks hope not to get burned by contract flare-ups. But underneath all this big news are a bunch of stories you might have missed. So we are going to wrap up our Invisible show today by bringing a little bit of extra visibility to the undercovered stories of the week. And here to help me do that is Peter Robison. He is Seattle Bureau Chief for Bloomberg News. Phyllis Fletcher is Managing Editor of Northwest News Network. And Justin Carter is Publisher of Capitol Hill Seattle Blog. Welcome back to Sound Effect, everybody.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And Phyllis, you are, I'm told, the first member of our Five Timers Club.
Yeah!
So you'll be shown into the lounge with Alec Baldwin following the roundtable discussion. But let's get started with Peter Robison. Peter, what's your underreported story this week?
Well, this is really on the theme of Invisible, but an entire community in Wallingford was uprooted and almost no one covered it. I think KPLU was among the people who did cover it. But over the last few years, a community of at least 40 people had developed on North Lake Way in Lake Union. And it was people living in their camper vans, and it was families, it was people with children. And the city gave them a deadline at the end of the month to move, and they moved with the help of housing shelters. But this just seems like a persistent issue that continues to not go away, and there has not been a good solution to it yet.
And so these are people living in like motorhomes, RVs, and stuff like that, but obviously not by choice. This is a variation on sort of tent cities and things like that. This is a different community.
Exactly. And they actually had been there long enough that they had a name for themselves. They knew it as Bangarang Village, which comes from a movie from the early 90s. But it just seems to also speak to income inequality to me. I mean, across the street is Westward, which was, you know, one of Bon Appetit's top new restaurants. So
the very visible contrast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What do we know about what the people wanted who were living there? Like if they wanted to be offered shelter, or if they wanted to be offered a place where, you guys can all go together.
Yeah. On Capitol Hill, we know that many that live in their automobiles especially are the working homeless. We see a lot of kids come in the summertime to work in kitchens and restaurants. Mm-hmm. And their best choice of temporary shelter is their car. And we see that on the Hill a lot.
Yeah.
Tell me again the name of it, Bangarang Village?
That's the name.
That's from a movie?
I've read that it's from Hook from 1991. Oh,
it was really?
The Lost Boys.
Oh, man. And they called themselves this?
Yes.
Oh.
That's interesting. I mean, that just shows that so many of these collections of people in unstable or transitional or non-existent housing, I mean, they have such strong community identities, and they often don't want to be broken up, even if it's to go and get more permanent housing elsewhere. I wonder if that's the case here or not.
That's exactly it. I live in Wallingford, and so I'm often on the Burke-Gilman Trail, and at the time that this agreement was hashed out, there were essentially community meetings happening every day, and you would see a group of people sitting in chairs and standing around, and they didn't want their community broken up.
Yeah. Oh.
Well, the dissolution of Bangarang Village, that community of homeless folks living in RVs and campers, is Peter Robison's undercovered story of the week. Phyllis Fletcher, on to you now. What's yours?
So this was a total surprise to me, but a privacy group, I guess some time ago, realized that there were police cameras on top of a couple of light posts in the Central District. And what was just confirmed this week is that they are owned not by Seattle Police, but by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And I'm not clear yet on how long they've been there, but I feel like we're going to learn a lot more about this. And I think that Justin knows a little bit more about it than I do.
Sure. I mean, I was at a press conference in July where the neighborhoods and the communities were talking about taking their streets back, and it was a real kind of a community call for new technologies, and actually representatives from ATF and FBI were there along with Chief O'Toole and the mayor, and they discussed surveillance cameras. But at that time, and this is in mid-July, the discussion was about – doing it right this time, proper channels, real public, transparent process. Well, it turns out if you go by the timeline of privacy advocates here in Seattle, these cameras were actually already installed at that time. And so the mayor and the chief actually were in front of the press and the public, either in ignorance or in just starting to understand what was going on at the federal level.
This is something we heard about in this forum. Tanya Mosley brought this up as an undercover story, the fact that some Central District residents wanted these cameras. They wanted more surveillance in order, you know, to increase public safety. And you're saying while they were asking for that, these cameras were already there?
These cameras were already in place, according to the privacy advocates. There's an uptick in gun violence in the area, and so there's definitely a serious problem going on. There's just two more shootings on, was it Wednesday or Thursday of this week? So there is a cause and a drive, but I do think this is another case where we're seeing the federal level of surveillance, and even just the local level of surveillance, it's going to be controversial. The public has just already spoken about wanting this to be a more transparent process, and once again, it's not.
And so besides the fact that we just learned about it, what was it that interests you about it, Phyllis?
Well, I was seeing some of that ambivalence play out on my own Facebook page of my friends, you know, saying, wow, I didn't know this. How long has this been here? I think I kind of like it, but I'm not sure, you know. So people having that inner conflict just within themselves of, I think I kind of want this, but now I'm a little uneasy knowing that it's actually there. You know, how's it going to be used? You know, all those questions that people have. You know, people brought up, yeah, I want to be safe. Obviously, there's been too many shootings. But then there's always that skepticism that kicks in, especially if you're Black, to wonder, well, how's it going to be used? Even if I'm not shooting someone, is it somehow going to be used against me?
Well, that's what I saw playing out. Well, I'll be interested to hear how the Central District residents feel about it now that they've got, got kind of what some of them were asking for, but not in the way that they were asking for it necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thanks for that. And Justin, as long as we're kind of in your neck of the woods, what's your story?
So imagine a very busy business district in Seattle suddenly being closed to cars for hours on a day, and then having the business owners actually support it. And that's what's going to actually start happening this weekend in a trial phase. But Pike Pine has a real problem with kind of closing time crowds. And so the way to address that, or at least to try to address that, is to try and close down East Pike between Broadway and 12th Avenue between 10 p.m. and 3 a.m. in a test that's going to start this Saturday night.
It's a little hard to imagine what it's going to look like. Do you have a sense of it?
I think it's going to look like a zoo. If you go through there any night, starting Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights, it already looks like a zoo, only a more crowded zoo. So this will be a more spread out, maybe like the plains of the Serengeti. I'm a little more, everybody will be free.
The wildebeest and the zebras uneasily coexisting.
And so, I mean, that's what we're hearing. I think a lot of the people who live in the area and work in the area understand it. I do think that there's a concern from some that it gets turned into this kind of festival that draws even more problems to the area, and they don't want to live in the middle of that.
Mm.
And they are planning to try some entertainment programming, as there'll be other trials through the month. So there'll be dancing one night. There'll be drag stars. There'll be LGBTQ-friendly entertainment to try and kind of address some of the street crime issues that we've seen in the neighborhood.
And you said that the business owners they're sort of withholding judgment on this? They're behind
it for now? Actually, a lot of them are really supportive of it, because a lot of the businesses in Pike Pine now are nightlife businesses. It's a nighttime trial, too. If this were a daytime closure, I think it'd be a much different conversation. But right now, most of the businesses that really care the most are nightlife, and they're into it.
Is there any thought to extending it to daytime hours also? Because especially around Elliott Bay and Oddfellows, that might be sort of a nice pedestrian area.
I think that there are constituencies that very much would like to see almost like a park-like transformation of some of those streets, maybe 10th Avenue. We've seen some people talking about even Pike being kind of like a Las Ramblas kind of Spanish
right.
plaza.
That's just what I was thinking.
But I think that is a long way off. And once you get a bunch of six-story apartment buildings around there, it's probably more likely. So just give it about 10 years.
Okay, no problem. All right, well, a pop-up pedestrian plaza in Capitol Hill. That's Justin Carter's undercover story. Just before we wrap up, I would like to tie this back into something that Peter Robison brought up, another undercover story, because it sounds like part of the reason for that pedestrian-only zone is to kind of cool things off a little bit, have everyone rub shoulders a little bit better at a tense time of night. And that tension, I think, feeds into your other undercover story, Peter.
Yes. Knut Berger wrote an interesting piece for Crosscut about the many forms of rage that are bubbling beneath Seattle Nice right now. And he mentioned traffic rage, parking rage, rent rage. And one element of this that I've noticed since moving here is that I came here in 98 and I had lived in Phoenix where they have giant arterial streets, 45 miles an hour. And I thought it was very quaint and homey that on these dinky neighborhood streets that you'd have to give way a lot. And when you gave way, people would, they give you a friendly wave. And I had, you know, a friend describe it as, you know, that's the Seattle friendly wave. And in the last few years, I just haven't seen that. I see people gritting their teeth and they're mad at traffic and they're looking at their phones. And I'm just curious if others have also noticed the loss of the friendly wave.
Actually, I want to know what your wife thinks, because I know she grew up here. What does she say about this?
She said, oh, they were never like that here.
Well, I have to say, when I moved here from Chicago, a place where people tend to be a little bit impatient, and I definitely was struck by the friendliness and the general sort of warmth of people to one another when they encounter each other in public spaces. And I think I agree. I think it's on the wane.
I'm on my bike all the time, and I would come at it from a different perspective. You hear about road rage and the war between cars and bikes, but actually one of the things that I experience that's the most dangerous is the overly polite driver. I get waved at all the time. Oh. They're like, go ahead. And they want me to go out into this intersection with cars zooming by. I think they're trying to get me.
To get you killed. it's actually Seattle
so
passive aggression.
I see plenty of the friendly wave, and I don't like it.
It's too much.
All right, well, I'm going to give you guys all the friendliest wave and invite you to come back to Sound Effect another time real soon. Thanks to all of our panelists this week, Peter Robison of Bloomberg News, Phyllis Fletcher of the Northwest News Network, and Justin Carter of Capitol Hill Seattle Blog. Come on back to Sound Effect sometime soon, eh, guys?
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.